Today is Thursday, December the 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Thank you for joining us. Coming up in the next half hour, Germany has expelled Russian diplomats over a state-ordered killing. And in the U.S., Congress voted to hold former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows in criminal contempt of Congress for refusing to appear for testimony before the select committee that is investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
So a lot of people are pointing to that book and saying, well, look, if he's willing to divulge these secrets in a book that's been published publicly, why can't he cooperate with a congressional committee that is trying to get to the bottom of an attack on the U.S. Capitol?
And analysts say that Iran, the United States, and Gulf Arab states are increasingly engaged in a struggle over the future of Iraq.
What we're seeing now is this free zone conflict that has emerged in Iraq, whereby Iran is trying to keep activities that its proxies use under a threshold of escalation.
And South Africa's High Court has ordered former President Jacob Zuma back to jail to serve out the remainder of his 15-month sentence for contempt of court. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, the House of Representatives voted to hold former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows in criminal contempt of Congress. The committee recommended that the Department of Justice pursue criminal charges against him for failing to appear for a deposition with the select committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Meadows is the first former member of Congress to be held in contempt of Congress in almost 200 years. Meadows briefly cooperated with the January 6th committee and provided documents and text messages before reversing and claiming executive privilege. For more on what this means for the investigation, I spoke to VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson. So, Catherine, thank you so much for joining us today. First question is, how significant is this vote by the House to recommend criminal contempt charges against Mark Meadows? And how is that different from the previous House vote to censure former Trump advisor Steve Bannon?
I think there are a number of ways that the vote this week is significant. First, because it proves that the House Select Committee on the events of January 6th is really and truly serious about getting to the bottom of what happened that day and pushing some of the former lawmakers, former administration officials, to really be held accountable for their actions on that day. And of course, as you mentioned, this is a charge of contempt against Mark Meadows, who was the White House Chief of Staff at the time of the January 6th riot and insurrection. He was a current administration official when these events took place. So while we've seen charges of contempt against Steve Bannon, who is a former Trump campaign associate, remember, he was not involved directly with the Trump administration on January 6th. Mark Meadows was. He was in the White House when those things were happening. He had a direct line to former President Trump. And as we saw from some of those text messages that were released by lawmakers this week, he had people pleading with him to go to former President Trump and find a way to stop this. He is one of the most important witnesses that the Select Committee will have in all of this.
Right. And as you said, ahead of the House vote to censure him, Representative Liz Cheney read a number of text messages turned over by Mr. Meadows himself, texts that he received during the January 6th attack. What did we learn from the text messages about the thinking of some of the high-profile Trump supporters about the events that were unfolding on that day?
What we have learned is that many Republican lawmakers were reaching out to Meadows in the days leading up to January 6th and planning a way to overturn the results of this legitimate election. They were also reaching out as the Trump supporters were swarming inside the Capitol and saying that they were in great danger and that they needed President Trump to call these people off. Otherwise, their lives would have been in danger. So this really paints a really important, startling picture into the events of that day. And Liz Cheney herself, when she was reading some of those out, said that getting to the bottom of what happened on January 6, 2021 was the great moral challenge of this generation, that it really put to test our ideas of democracy and whether we support free and fair elections in this country.
And what do you make of Mr. Meadows' decision to first cooperate and then cease cooperation? And then I guess he sued the committee after publishing his book. And how does that undermine his argument of executive privilege?
Right. So Meadows initially cooperated with the committee, as you noted, turning over thousands of pages of personal documents, personal emails, personal text messages, claiming that those were non-privileged documents. But when the committee came to him and asked for additional documents, he said that those were covered under the claims of executive privilege that former President Trump himself has evoked. And Meadows is arguing that he is not able to provide those documents if the former president is saying that he can't do it as well. The Democrats on the Select Committee see this issue very, very differently. They argue that because President Biden has waived that claim of executive privilege for former President Trump, all of that supersedes these arguments of executive privilege, and that Meadows should be compelled to cooperate with the committee. And of course, Meadows himself has also recently published a book where he reveals the inner workings of the Trump White House. So a lot of people are pointing to that book and saying, well, look, if he's willing to divulge these secrets in a book that's been published publicly, why can't he cooperate with a congressional committee that is trying to get to the bottom of an attack on the U.S. Capitol?
That was VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson. Voice of America! Germany has expelled Russian diplomats of a state-ordered killing. AP's correspondent Charles Deledesma reports.
Germany's foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, says her country's expelling the two diplomats after a court concluded that Moscow was behind the killing of a Chechen man in Berlin 2 years ago. Baerbock called the state-ordered slaying a grave breach of German law. Russia's ambassador in Berlin has been summoned to discuss the court's finding. The 2019 Brazen Daylight killing sparked outrage in Berlin and previously prompted the German government to expel two Russian diplomats then, a move Russia swiftly reciprocated at the time. I'm Charles Deledesma.
And Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese leader Xi Jinping held a video call to discuss bilateral relations and international affairs. AP's Charles Deledesma joins us again.
In their opening remarks, Putin and Xi hailed relations between Russia and China, with the Russian leader declaring them a proper example of interstate cooperation in the 21st century. Xi, for his part, said the Russian president strongly supported China's efforts to protect key national interests and firmly opposed attempts to drive a wedge between our countries. The summit comes amid heightened tensions between Moscow and the West over a Russian troop build-up near Ukrainian borders that's stoking fears of a possible invasion. I'm Charles Deledesma.
During a speech in Jakarta, Indonesia, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called on China to stop aggressive actions in the Indo-Pacific region. Beijing has already rejected Blinken's assertions, as VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Antony Blinken is on his first visit to Southeast Asia as Secretary of State, starting off his trip in Indonesia. It's a heavyweight country in a critical region, says Brian Harding of the United States Institute of Peace.
It's clear that Southeast Asia, sitting at the heart of the Indo-Pacific region, is really the region of the world where U.S.-China strategic competition is playing out most acutely. But there are also innumerable reasons why the United States should be interested in Southeast Asia with 650 million people, a $3 trillion economy. So Secretary Blinken choosing to travel to Indonesia first is the right move.
Freedom of navigation in the South China Sea is a focal point of Blinken's visit to an area where, he said, China's actions threaten the movement of those $3 trillion in goods annually. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
That's why there's so much concern from Northeast Asia to Southeast Asia. and from the Mekong River to the Pacific Islands about Beijing's aggressive actions, claiming open seas as their own, distorting open markets through subsidies to its state-run companies, denying the exports or revoking deals for countries whose policies it does not agree with, engaging in illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing activities. Countries across the region want this behavior to change. We do too.
China was quick to refute Blinken's criticism. Wang Wenbin is the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson.
I would like to point out that the U.S., on the one hand, dramatically plays up the so-called China threat while claiming to have no intention to start a conflict with China on the other. This kind of self-contradictory practice does not accord with the spirit of the recent meeting between our two heads of state and will struggle to gain approval from the countries in the region.
Confrontations with Chinese vessels are frequent in the disputed South China Sea. Blinken made clear the U.S. wants to ensure people and countries in the region have the freedom to decide on their own futures and partners. Here again, Brian Harding, who spoke with VOA.
Southeast Asian countries, more than anything, do not want to choose between the United States and China or any of their other partners. It is inevitable that the United States, China, and also Japan, India, Australia are going to be deep and important players for these countries. And trying to force them to choose is a bad policy, but setting out what the United States brings to the table, that's a good policy, and that's what he did, I think.
Blinken is also visiting Malaysia and Thailand on this trip, where the impact of the military coup in Myanmar is likely to be a key issue. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
A UN Human Rights Council debate on Ukraine Wednesday drifted into criticism of Russia's large-scale military buildup along the Ukrainian border. U.S. and British representatives voiced support for Ukraine, while a Russian diplomat completely ignored the issue. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The debate in Geneva was called to discuss the human rights situation in Ukraine. The UN Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights, Nada Al-Nashif, presented a carefully balanced report on civic space and fundamental freedoms in the country. She criticized the Ukrainian government for restricting the free expression of critical opinion in the media, as well as attacks against opposition political parties. She then pivoted to the self-proclaimed republics in eastern Ukraine, backed by the Russian government. She criticized the lack of freedom of expression and condemned the arbitrary detention of social media users for expressing their views online. Her most vociferous criticisms were aimed at Russia and its illegal occupation of the Autonomous Republic of Crimea and the city of Sevastopol.
We continue to document violations of international human rights and international humanitarian law. Journalists who expressed dissenting or critical views were subjected to surveillance, criminal prosecution, arrests, prohibition of entry into Crimea, and deportation from Crimea.
Al-Nashif did not touch upon the buildup of about 100,000 Russian troops amassed at the Ukrainian border. But that topic stimulated a heated debate among nations attending the council session. Britain's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Simon Manley, said his country was monitoring the situation in Ukraine closely.
Russia's activity poses a threat to Ukraine's and international security. We stand with our allies to defend the frontiers of freedom. And we call on Russia to bring an end to its threatening and destabilizing behavior and to respect and protect the human rights of people living in illegally annexed Crimea and non-government-controlled eastern Ukraine.
Ukraine's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Yevhenia Filipenko, echoed these fears.
If Russia does not de-escalate its current large-scale military build-up along the Ukrainian border, the impact of possible invasion will have disastrous consequences for security, humanitarian, and human rights situation in my country and well beyond.
U.S. Human Rights Officer Patrick Elliott gave assurances of Washington's unwavering support of Ukraine's sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity. First Secretary of the Russian Permanent Mission in Geneva, Yaroslav Eremin, did not respond to any of these criticisms. Instead, he expressed concern about Ukraine's closure of Russia's language channels and the stigmatization of people working for Russian language media. He urged the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights to stop including in its reports matters related to Russian regions. Belarus was the only country to ally itself with Russia. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
After almost 2 years of strict COVID-19 controls, Australia has reopened its borders to skilled migrants, students and backpackers. Australia banned most foreign nationals in March 2020 under some of the world's toughest coronavirus restrictions. From Sydney, Phil Masser reports.
Holders of various working and student visas are now allowed into Australia without requiring an exemption if they're fully vaccinated. Japanese and South Korean nationals are also permitted into the country. Australia had already relaxed travel restrictions to allow the return of citizens, permanent residents and their families. All arrivals will have to follow the quarantine rules of the state or territory to which they travel. There are no entry restrictions on travellers entering the states of New South Wales and Victoria. However, international passengers need government approval to travel to Western Australia. Industries across the country, from agriculture to hospitality, that rely on short-term workers, have been struggling to find staff since the country closed its borders in March 2020. They hope the reopening of Australia's international borders will ease the worker shortage. Universities are also preparing to welcome back overseas students. Yongjin Liu has arrived from Hong Kong to study at the University of New South Wales.
It's actually a mixed feeling of very exciting, but also because everything is new here. And this is my first time to live in a foreign country, so a little bit nervous.
It's also so-called Freedom Day for the unvaccinated in the state of New South Wales, where many restrictions will end for those who've not been inoculated. New South Wales Health Minister Brad Hazzard is expecting coronavirus infections to increase, but says there are no plans to reimpose restrictions.
Once the unvaccinated are mixing in with the vaccinated, you'd have to expect the numbers will increase even further, and that's worrying because that puts pressure on our doctors and our nurses. We're not about to start backflipping on issues that we've promised the community will do.
Australia is relaxing disease control measures despite rising infections and concerns about the effectiveness of vaccines against the Omicron variant. New South Wales Wednesday recorded 1,360 new COVID-19 infections, its highest daily total since mid-September. Australia has detected about 230,000 COVID-19 cases since the start of the pandemic. Some 2,100 people have died. The health department has said that 89.5% of the eligible Australian population is fully vaccinated. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Voice of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Bunganyi. Iran, the United States, and Gulf Arab states are increasingly engaged in a struggle over the future of Iraq, analysts say. The question that looms over 2022, they believe, is whether the emerging Iraqi political makeup following October's parliamentary elections will be able to advance Iraqi sovereignty in the context of its geopolitical tug of war. Del Gavlak reports from Amman.
Marking Iraq's centenary celebration on December 11, Prime Minister Mustafa al-Qadhimi urged all Iraqis to recognize what unites rather than what divides them for the sake of Iraq's common good. The country's federal court is expected to uphold the October parliamentary election results praised by Iraqi and international observers, despite repeated efforts by defeated pro-Iranian Shiite parties who want them annulled. Their representation has dropped significantly to some 17 seats, compared with Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr's party with 74. Writing in the El Monitor website, Iraqi observer Omar Sattar said Sadr wants to form a majority government opposing all foreign interference and to disarm militias. The pro-Iran forces are countering Sadr's aspirations by taking to the street, threatening civil peace, and working to annul the election results. Reaching a middle ground could take a long time. Elections were held early in response to mass protests against the government in 2019, but there are concerns about powerful armed groups, many linked to Iran, that still hold sway. There have been no arrests or charges following a failed assassination attempt on al-Qadhimi in November. Senior analyst Nicholas Haras with the New Lines Institute in Washington tells VOA that Iraq is at a crossroads and its sovereignty is at stake.
Fundamentally, it will require Iraqi leaders working across Iraqi society to try to build bridges among communities in Iraq that have a very difficult experience of living together, both under Saddam Hussein and in the wake of his regime. That is going to be a challenge, and that is the great existential question for Iraq, as Iraq is in process of becoming a failed state divided along its various regions, dominated by various different identity communities.
Observers say that al-Qadhimi has been a moderating force for Iraq and has tried to draw Iraq back into the Arab fold through economic deals with Jordan and Egypt, while mediating between regional rivals Saudi Arabia and Iran. Osama el-Sharif, a Middle East political commentator in Amman, called these moves anathema to the pro-Iran proxies. Meanwhile, as 2021 drew to a close, U.S.-led coalition forces ended their combat mission in Iraq this month, transferring some 2,500 troops combating Islamic State into a training and advising role. But observers say Iran wants the U.S. out of Iraq. Nicholas Haras.
Qadhimi is viewed as a symbol of U.S. support in Iraq. And so what we're seeing now is this zone conflict that has emerged in Iraq, whereby Iran is trying to keep activities that its proxies use under a threshold of escalation that would prevent a strong U.S. or, for that matter, Qadhimi-backed response.
Osama el-Sharif, writing in the Saudi Arab News Daily, said election winner Muqtada al-Sadr has praised Prime Minister Mustafa al-Qadhimi's efforts to keep Iraq neutral in the U.S.-Iran showdown. He said al-Sadr may even keep al-Qadhimi on as prime minister, even if this is anathema to his Shiite rivals. This would be a major step forward for Iraq, which is trying to revive its national identity and rejoin the Arab fold. If al-Sadr succeeds in toppling the ethno-sectarian system, he says, it will be a historic milestone in the country's recovery, but his failure could be disastrous on all fronts. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
And in other news, the Canadian government implored its residents not to leave the country as provinces ramp up vaccinations to combat the fast-spreading Omicron coronavirus variant, even as efforts to head off a rising COVID-19 wave are complicated by public fatigue over the pandemic. And Lithuania's diplomatic delegation to China left the country on Wednesday in a hastily arranged exit, diplomatic sources said, as relations soured further over Taiwan, which opened a de facto embassy in Vilnius last month. Beijing, which has stepped up diplomatic pressure on countries to sever relations with the island, downgraded diplomatic ties with Lithuania in November after Taiwan opened a representative office in the Baltic state's capital. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. And remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, we are on Facebook, and on Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our videos. Just search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Istanbul will host a two-day African summit this week, the latest effort by Turkey to expand its diplomatic and economic influence in Africa. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
After a two-year delay caused by the COVID pandemic, Istanbul begins hosting the Turkey-Africa Partnership Summit on Friday. But with the Omicron variant spreading hours before the start, it remained unclear who would attend. The summit is part of an effort that has seen Turkey opening 30 new embassies while pushing an aggressive trade policy. Jalal Hajawi is a senior fellow at the Geneva-based Global Initiative, whose work concentrates on North Africa's security landscape.
A lot of consulates and embassies, which is not the trend followed by a typical Western country. Usually Western nations are closing down their diplomatic representation in Africa, regardless of how important it might be over the next couple of decades. And the Turks are also very convincing because they work fast. They offer construction projects at relatively affordable prices. They adapt to the culture.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is a regular visitor to Africa, visiting the continent 28 times since 2003. But Turkey's ambitions are creating points of friction, stoking rivalries with France, a former colonial power in much of the continent. And in the Libyan conflict, it backed the side opposed to the faction supported by Egypt. A rivalry that has led to Turkish businesses complaining they've been forced out of the lucrative Egyptian market. Ali Eren is a CEO of Erensan, a Turkish company that exports industrial boilers.
In Egypt, there is quite good textile industry there, and also automotive and other types of industries where we can, you know, find ourselves very comfortable in this industrial environment there. Also technical people. So Egypt has been a loss for us.
Turkish and Egyptian diplomats have been holding talks to improve ties, and those talks may continue on the sidelines of the Istanbul summit. There will also be discussions on trade. Ankara touts the recent sale of military drones to Morocco as an important breakthrough for the Turkish defense industry. State figures show Turkey's trade with Africa has increased fivefold to $25 billion since 2003, much less than China's. For Erdogan, it pays huge political dividends at home. So says observers like Yusuf Kenan Kucuk, a former Turkish diplomat to Sudan.
The government can portray itself to its voters as being a global player or supporting the friendly government, like Muslim states, for instance, Somalia in Africa. So it is very much appreciated, in fact, in Turkish public, Turkey's engagement in Africa. So I think it is that the three things: Turkey's international visibility, a trade partner, and the domestic politics.
With the Turkish economy hit by a currency crisis, Erdogan will welcome any boost the summit can bring. But analysts warn a looming economic crisis will mean Ankara may not have the funding to sustain its efforts in Africa. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
And South Africa's High Court has ordered former President Jacob Zuma back to jail to serve out the remainder of his 15-month sentence for contempt of court. It called the decision in September to release Zuma on medical parole and lawful, as Linda Gaftas reports from Johannesburg.
There is no evidence South Africa's former president, Jacob Zuma, is terminally ill or incapacitated, the country's high court said Wednesday in reversing a decision to grant him medical parole. The court slammed the national commissioner who granted Zuma medical parole in September, calling the decision irrational and based on irrelevant considerations. Zuma was found guilty of contempt of court in June and sentenced to 15 months in prison for failing to appear before a national inquiry into state graft. The 79-year-old's arrest in July sparked protests among his supporters. The street action spiraled into riots and looting in his home province of KwaZulu-Natal and the country's economic hub of Gauteng. Threats of unrest were previously cited as reason to support Zuma's parole application, but in Wednesday's ruling, the court deemed it groundless for releasing an offender. The court also ruled that his time on medical parole doesn't count towards his sentence, so Zuma will have to fulfill the entirety of his sentence behind bars. Opposition Democratic Alliance leader John Steenhuisen called the judgment a big victory for the rule of law and the principle of equality before the rule of law. The former president's education charity, the Jacob Zuma Foundation, called the court's ruling clearly wrong and said his legal team has already filed an appeal. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Funganyi in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization
and Africa Center for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands with soap and water or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa Center for Disease Control. And remember to listen to